Dear conference participants, honorable guests, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the University of Jyväskylä, it is my great honor to officially open the 5th European Congress in Conservation Biology. I have also great pleasure to welcome you all to our vibrant student city of Jyväskylä and to Finland, some of you. Our city is the sport capital of Finland, the origin of the famous school system appraised by the International PISA studies, and the county dedicated for well-being. We are extremely delighted to host the ECCB in Jyväskylä because the theme of this Congress perfectly aligns with our vision of sustainable future where human and planetary well-being are in unison. We are proud of our scientists who are internationally esteemed but do not only perform top-level science but also make a great effort to disseminate the scientific findings to public and practice. In order to support these activities, we have very recently established a multidisciplinary platform named as Resource Wisdom. This is to join our efforts to ensure sustainable and rich ecosystems for generations to come. On my behalf, I wish you a very fruitful Congress, innovative dialogue with your colleagues, and also hope that you have a chance to enjoy our beautiful city. Once more, welcome and thank you.
Good morning, everybody, and it's my pleasure to warmly welcome you all to Jyväskylä and to the 5th European Congress in Conservation Biology. My name is Mikko Mönkkönen, and I have been chairing the local organizing committee. And the art performance we just saw in the beginning of this opening ceremony was produced us by dance ensemble Krampi, and the name of the artwork was Human Made. Let's give one more time applause to this wonderful. This conference, ECCP 2018, is jointly organized by the Society for Conservation Biology and its Europe section and the Department of Biological and Environmental Sciences at the University of Jyväskylä. The department is one of the largest departments in this university, and it has three main focal research areas. One of them is cell and molecular biology and nanobiology. Second one is ecology and evolutionary research. And third one is natural resources and the environment. Now I would like to make three questions, and only those people who come from outside Finland can answer. So Finns, don't answer. How many of you knew that there is city of Jyväskylä before we start advertising this Congress? Some at least. How many of you knew before we start advertising this conference that Jyväskylä University is one of the main universities in Finland? Perhaps 10. How many of you knew beforehand that conservation biology and environmental biology are one of the strong research areas here in Jyväskylä? Perhaps 10 people. I'm asking these questions because our vision is to be the Finnish hub and internationally renowned institute in conservation biology. And my dear colleagues here in Jyväskylä, we have some work ahead of us. And I also take this opportunity to announce that pretty soon we will have full professorship open in environmental and conservation biology. That will happen most likely in early autumn or late summer. So follow us if you are interested in becoming full professor here in Jyväskylä in conservation biology and environmental biology. The theme of this conference is planetary well-being. It's a concept that captures the well-being of people as well as the integrity and sustainability of Earth's ecosystems. We live in the Anthropocene. It's an era characterized by growing human population, extensive urbanization, unsustainable use of many of our planet's natural resources, and fast-paced global warming. These are the main drivers threatening global biodiversity and the ecosystem functions and services that are so vital to all life on Earth. Although many international conventions have been committed to halting and even reversing land degradation, biodiversity loss, and climate change, it is still very clear empirical truth that negative environmental trends continue. There is only one Earth available to support us, and therefore our urgent task is to discover how to balance between human resource exploitation and protection of our planet's biological diversity. And that's what ECCP 2018 is all about. During the next few days, we will hear more about the trends and threats to biodiversity, but also we will have a prime possibility to discuss about science-based solution to these problems. So the theme of the Congress is planetary well-being. To well-be or not to well-be? Well, that's the question. Under this very general theme of planetary well-being, we have been recognizing, thanks to your contributions, some more special themes. First of them is forests and climate, and forest biodiversity and forest and climate change. Especially today, we will have several talks and sessions with dealing with the forest's role in climate change mitigation and how we should manage our forests globally and here in the boreal zone, and to use the extracted biomass if we aim to restrict global warming under 2 degrees. As we all know, forests have a huge potential to store and sequester carbon, and thus climate-smart use of our forest is a key question from European and also global perspective. And it's a political, important and hot topic, particularly here in the north, because of the role of the forest in climate change mitigation. Forests also harbor much of our biodiversity in a boreal forest. Second special theme that I recognized from the program is biodiversity offsetting or ecological compensations. These are key components of so-called no-net loss biodiversity conservation policies, which are increasingly widespread and yet highly controversial. And this is particularly true of biodiversity offsets, a key component of no-net loss policies. Tomorrow, Wednesday, we will be hearing many talks and have possibilities to participate in discussion about implementation of no-net loss policies. Related to this theme, tomorrow, Wednesday, there is a special stakeholder day. And we have invited representatives from the industry business sector, particularly from the mining industry, and consultants working in mining business to discuss with us about biodiversity offsetting and no-net loss policies. This is because we see stakeholder engagement really important during our meeting. So that we conservation scientists do not just talk to each other, to like-minded people, but expose ourselves to a dialogue with the society. Sometimes we scientists are blamed for keeping ourselves to the ivory towers where we, in our impenetrable kindness, occasionally train our findings to the society. Although conservation science and practice have great strides in steering the society toward ecological sustainability, there is still a large gap between the research and practice. Yes, we do know many companies cause harm to our environment, but we do believe that the solution is not staying in separate foxholes, but rather in a direct dialogue between different stakeholders. This way, we hope that we will create common understanding and hopefully also mutual respect, which may then turn into solutions. With these words, I warmly welcome you all to ECCP 2018 in Jyväskylä. Welcome. Okay, now I would like to ask Beke Jonsson and Debbie Luke. Beke, we all know who Beke is. Beke is president of the Society of Conservation Biology Europe section. Beke, your turn. Oh. Okay.
Thank you, Mikko. In August 2006, I was sitting in the sun outside a conference hotel in the lovely city of Eger in Hungary. And I were sitting there together with a group of Finnish researchers and friends. And we were celebrating the splendid idea of going to a European Congress of Conservation Biology. Of course, we knew that conservation biology research is strong in Europe, and that's the reason why we went there, of course. But we were still very impressed about the program that were before us, the number of participants and the quality of the research that were going to be presented. And little did we know at that point how the ECCBs, the congresses, would develop into what I believe now is a major meeting platform for science, for our science in Europe. And interestingly, it's very much the same group of people who were sitting outside the hotel in the sun in Eger 12 years ago that are now standing on the podium today and welcoming all of you to the 5th European Congress of Conservation Biology. So I would like, on behalf of the Europe section of the Society, to express my sincere gratitude to our Finnish colleagues for taking on this task of hosting the conference. And there are many that should be thanked, and I can assure you there's going to be lots of thanks from the podiums for various contributions to the conference. But at this point, I really would like to direct a special thanks to Janne Seppänen and Peerage of Science for actually saving us at a very, very critical moment when we realized that we didn't have an abstract submission system in place. With short notice and for almost no cost, Janne set up Peerage of Science for a new task and provided an innovative system that actually have engaged us all in a process towards a scientific program of high quality. I think that, and finally he also provided us with this nice online version of the program. I think that there is no one here that can actually imagine the number of hours that he has put into navigating all the technical and practical details and responding to what I guess it's hundreds, maybe thousands of emails relating to this process. So many, many thanks, Janne, wherever you are. The Society for Conservation Biology is our society. It is us. And for those of you who are actually live or work here in Europe, the Europe section is your section. and together we create our identity, and we should represent an important voice for conservation science in Europe. And we in the Europe Section Board, we are hoping that many more of you would become engaged and support the work of the section. So please take the opportunity during the conference to visit us at our booth in the fantastic poster area and coffee break room. We are there all during all the breaks. And also take note on our membership assembly that is going to happen on Thursday afternoon. I hope to see many of you in this room and having a discussion around the on the section activities. So with these words, and on behalf of the Europe Section of Society for Conservation Biology, I welcome you all to the 5th European Congress of Conservation Biology, and I also take the chance to congratulate you for coming here to learn from, to share with, and enjoy each other during this week. So, welcome.
Well, good morning. Well, good morning. Oh, that's much better. Thank you. I am honored and privileged to be here. My name is Deborah Luke. I'm the Executive Director for the Society for Conservation Biology. So thank you for inviting me for being here, Bege. And I want to thank Bege for all the work that he's done as your section president, your Europe section president. He serves on the Global Board of Directors for SCB also, and he represents all of you. And he's played a very vital role here in that capacity. I'd also like to thank Mikko for all the work that he's done. And he mentioned the local organizing committee, but I understand how much work that whole committee does. So can I have people that are on the local organizing committee just stand up for a second? I've only got 2 minutes, so stand up. Thank you. Pulling off a conference this size, and there's over 800 of you that will be here, is no easy task. So well done to all of you. I mentioned that Bege is on the board of directors for the society itself, but I was also privileged to sit in on your Europe section board meeting yesterday and met your board members who also do an enormous amount of work for your section. Can I have you stand up for just a second, please? Board members. There you go. So the Europe section is one of 7 sections that forms the Society of Conservation Biology, and it's a really important section. Your work is amazing, it's important, and it's vital to the well-being of this planet. The SCB's mission is to advance the science and practice of conserving Earth's biodiversity. So that's something we can all relate to. It's all we're striving for. It's all we're working towards. I agree completely with Mikko that we are important to be talking amongst ourselves as leaders in science and practice and education, but it's also really important to expand our reach and our partnerships and our conversations so that we can move forward with the efforts that we need to actually face the challenges that our planet is facing today. So thank all of you for being here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really looking forward to this week, to meeting all of you, to hearing from you, to learning about your work. I am going to end by taking a selfie with all of you because my communications person, and I am not good at this, I am the first to admit it, says that social media is the thing. So we have a challenge now between all of our sections on who's going to post the most, because I'm going to several section meetings, so it's going to be the same challenge. So you have your hashtag here. You also have at society with the number 4, ConBio, and you can do whatever you do with that, but I'm going to try this. You are the ones who make up the society. You are the ones that make up the European section. I thank the board, I thank the local organizing committee, but almost as importantly, I thank all of you for being part of this society and for doing what we need to do to help save our Earth. Thank you.
Next, I would like to give the podium to the scientific committee, the two co-chairs of the scientific committee, Nuria and Janne, please.
Hi, everybody. Janne and I would like to thank, first of all, to all the members of the scientific committee for the time and the work in reviewing abstracts and making better the contributions. Also to Steph Januchowski, I don't know if she's here, for her great help in organizing the plenaries. And to Emilia Lampi. Emilia, are you here? No, she's working. So she was really, she did an amazing job really with tracking all the requests from all of you, all the participants. Also thanks to all the session chairs and to organizers of symposiums and workshops. And I would like to say that also be back to Peerage of Science, because it has changed the way that we participate in a Congress. In fact, we started participating much earlier than today by reading the abstract, something that sometimes even we don't have time to do, and interacting with each other and getting familiar with topics. So this is the program of all of us. So thanks to all of you for making possible this collaborative way, and just enjoy your program. Thank you.
And don't go, I will introduce Anne with you here.
Okay. Yeah.
Good morning, everybody, from my side as well. I would actually like to thank Nuria very much, because without her patience and tolerance of non-responsive co-chairs of the scientific committee, we wouldn't have the program.
No.
So, Nuria, thank you very
much. It's not
true.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I hope you really enjoy the program. Yeah.
Okay. And then it is our great pleasure to start the real program of the conference. And we really have a pleasure to have two great ladies from the top of global biodiversity policy to open the session of this Congress for us. So first, we will hear from Dr. Annelari Godri, who is the first Executive Secretary of the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. And she assumed the office in 2014, so not that many years ago. Anne is a plant molecular ecologist on training, and she did her PhD on plant ecology. During the few years that she has been directing IPES, she has already overseen the production of 7 IPES assessments. First 2 were approved by the governments in Kuala Lumpur in 2016. That was pollinators, pollination, and food production. And the other one was scenarios and models of biodiversity and ecosystem services. The further 5 assessments were approved by the government in Medellin, Colombia, just 3 months ago. 4 regional assessments on biodiversity and ecosystem services, and the global assessment on land degradation and restoration. Today, Anne will provide us with an overview of the work of IPES, looking at some of the impacts of the most recent assessment on policy and key messages of the European and Central Asian assessment on biodiversity and ecosystem services. Please welcome Annelari Godri.
Thank you, Janne. You already gave part of my talk.
So, dear colleagues and friends, it's really a pleasure to have the opportunity to address the ECCB 2018 this morning. Greetings to all. It's also really a pleasure to share the opening session this morning with Dr. Christiana Pascal-Palmer, the Executive Secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity. I would really like to thank the small army of organizers who've put together this great program that we have ahead of us this week. I thank Yanné Kotiaho, of course, for helping me to prepare for this this morning. But also, and very importantly, I'd like to thank the Society for Conservation Biology itself for all of the great support that it has been providing to IBES at all times, and this since the early stages of negotiation of the IBES mechanism itself. So thank you very much for that. As you see, I have modestly entitled my talk, Harnessing the Power of Knowledge to Save Biodiversity. This is the vision of IBES. I believe it's also the vision that we share here today within the scientific community, the real deep belief that together we can increase the power of knowledge to bear upon decision-making, to better inform decision-making for ultimately a more positive outcome for biodiversity and ecosystem services, particularly in these troubled times of fake news where it matters more and more to really reaffirm the power of science. As IPCC celebrate 30 years of work, we at IBES celebrate about 5 years in our young life. And IBES is about assessing the state of knowledge related to biodiversity, to ecosystem services. What IBES does is to look at status and trends of biodiversity of ecosystem services, analyzing published literature. It also looks at the impact of these changes. It looks at the causes, and very importantly, it also looks at options for action. What I would like to do is give you a sense of the impact that some of our reports are starting to have, starting with the pollination assessment, then looking at the scenarios and models assessment. That will be the first part of the talk, major part of the talk. And the second part will be to give you some highlights of the Europe and Central Asia assessments of biodiversity and ecosystem services, which was just released a couple of months ago. As I mentioned before, IBES is very much inspired from IPCC. We sometimes call ourselves an IPCC-like mechanism for biodiversity. And what we do is to assess the state of knowledge and deliver it to policymakers, to governments, to civil societies in response to their requests for that information. So we've already, as Yanné mentioned, released 7 reports in our young life. We've been quite busy, and we have produced a report on pollination. That was mentioned. That was the first report. It was done in 2 years, quite a quick work. We also released the second report, which was a methodological assessment of scenarios and models. I'll talk about that a bit later. And then recently, we released 5 reports, 4 assessments in the regions, and 1 of land degradation and restoration. And each time we release a report, we also build a policy component where we look at instruments that we have in terms of policies and tools. We have an ambitious capacity building program, for example, with an early career fellowship program where we support 2 early career scientists per each chapter of each assessment to work as experts together with the other experts selected as part of the process so that they can learn and become the next generation of people who are going to be involved in IBES in doing this important science policy work. And that's my last bullet here on this slide. We are also committed to highlighting gaps in knowledge and to flag those to research funding agencies in particular, and in order to influence the scientific agenda so that more knowledge is addressing the highlighted gaps. Next time IBES assesses that topic again, the body of knowledge will have grown. So we go hand in hand between the policy and the work of IBES and then the advance in knowledge from the scientific community. Before I dive into the assessment themselves, just a little bit on process, because within IBES, just like within IPCC, we sometimes say that the process is almost as important as the product itself. And what this means is that the people who are requesting the work are also going to be at times involved in reviewing this work so that they form a part of it, they buy in, and at the end it has been co-constructed and they are going to then be empowered to use it. That's really at the heart of the vision. So typically an assessment would start with a request from governments, and at the end, it would end with approval, word by word, of the summary for policymakers of that assessment by governments. This is what you see here. First, the governments, together with other stakeholders, that includes SCB, for example, are going to be invited to approve a scoping report, which outlines the chapters and some of their contents. That is the mandate for scientists. Then there will be nominations by governments, by organizations for experts who are going to be selected. Then we leave them alone. They do their work, they meet, they produce chapters, then executive summaries, then from those the summary for policymakers. And at various times during this work, there are periods where we invite the scientific community and other knowledge holders for peer reviewing chapters. That's when we build the scientific credibility and quality. And we also, at times, invite governments to review drafts of the summary for policymakers. And that's when we build the policy relevance. Governments are going to say, we don't understand your scientific jargon. You are not addressing our policy questions. This is not policy relevant enough. And then experts are going to go back and fine-tune their work. So that's, in a nutshell, the process that is followed for the production of all of the assessment reports of IBES, just like it is for IPCC. The overall context we move in is one in which there are some important policy mechanisms. First of all, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and the Sustainable Development Goals. As this community very well knows here, there are two goals which are represented at the basis of this tree here that are related to biodiversity. But within IBES and here as well, we have a greater ambition, of course. We not only want to look at the status of biodiversity itself, but what we're interested in is to see how biodiversity supports life on Earth of other creatures, how biodiversity supports development, food, the quality of water, health. And we really want to demonstrate that without sound biodiversity, without a quality in the environment, we are not going to be able to reach all of our development goals. So that is for the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, and another important policy mechanism that we use and that we address is, of course, the Strategic Plan for Biodiversity 2011-2020, and now the discussions for the post-2020 strategic plan. And I'm sure that Christiana will be addressing that part, and of course also the Paris Agreement on climate change. So now moving into giving you some highlights of the impacts of our two first assessments, starting with the pollination assessment, which again was a two-year exercise following the same process, but really crushed in 2 years because IBES was really eager to have a first product to show. And so it was the result of the analysis of several thousands of papers, as you see here, as well as bringing in indigenous and local knowledge. And it led, as every assessment, to chapters with executive summaries and a summary for policymakers, which was approved word by word by governments at one of the IBES plenaries. So that summary for policymakers has some key findings. I have pasted some here. I'm not going to read them. It came up with a lot of new numbers from the literature. And very importantly, at the bottom here, you see that it also highlighted a number of actions which were detailed in the chapter, a number of suggestions for actions in various sectors to promote pollination and to conserve pollinators. So in terms of its early impact, I have given you some highlights. First, and perhaps very symbolically, but we were quite proud of it, when the UN General Assembly approved a World Bee Day. It was the first this year. I hope you are all aware of that. And so 20th of May was the first World Bee Day, and that's entirely based on the decision of the Convention on Biological Diversity on Pollination, which is itself based on the IBES report. Those are the two mechanisms that are cited in the decision of this symbolic decision of the United Nations General Assembly. Then there was a very detailed decision from the Conference of the Parties 13 in Cancun in December 2016 that endorsed the key messages of the pollination assessment. We were there, of course. We presented the conclusion. And it drew out a number of implications. It detailed a number of options for actions to all of the parties, 193, I believe, parties to the CBD, almost universal membership, so quite powerful. And from now on and since that time, governments are including a report on the status of their pollinators as part of their report to that convention. And in June at the SUPSTA, we are going to hear from governments on how they've been complying with that decision. At the national level, there is an increasing list of countries that are adopting national legislations to promote pollinators. For example, in my country, France, the report was presented to the Senate. It was a very good timing, and there already had been thoughts about having a legislation on pollinators, and so the report just came at the right time. And following this, and of course other work, there was a national legislation that was approved. There is also a consortium of countries which is growing, which has signed a commitment to implementing the findings of the pollination assessment. There are many actions, not just at the government level, but also in civil society. On top here, inspired by the assessment, this is a report from a number of institutes in France that are, it's a very technical report on how to exploit roadsides as well as other green corridors, abandoned lands to promote pollinators. It explains what you can seed, what type of techniques you can use for the soil management, for example, so that, for example, in order to seed exotic species which might cause some other problems, you can use those abandoned lands, as you very well know, to promote pollinators. And then the bottom one is the luxury industry, perfume, where there is now, with some good work with the FRB in France, the Research Foundation for Biodiversity, some education program around the world. It's the global company to teach on pollination out of the awareness of that perfume company that a lot of the primary products they use is the result of the work of pollinators. So I now switch to a different type of impact. That was our second report. It was a methodological report this time, so on scenarios and models, not doing new scenarios, but analyzing the tools that we have in order to project future pathways based on different trajectories of indirect drivers, such as population growth or changes in economy, also looking at different pathways of drivers. And then this report also was the object of a decision from the Convention on Biological Diversity. There is going to be new work done in the context of the Global Biodiversity Outlook 5, which is the basis for the post-2020 discussions on what the world will adopt next at its as its targets for biodiversity. But the main point I wanted to highlight here was that it was on method, so it really was to highlight the gaps that we have in our knowledge, and that has led to a wealth of new research projects, new funding, new opportunities. I have showed this example here because it's the a rather large one of an investment of 25 million euros. The call just closed from the European Union. That's their Biodiversa ERANET project together with Belmont Forum, which is a consortium of research funding agencies around the world. They've put together this pot of money to directly address the gaps that were highlighted regarding scenarios and models by the IBES methodological assessment. So that's a different type of impact. And now there is an expert group on scenarios and models within IBES that is actually doing some new work on scenarios itself, with some collaboration with colleagues involved in IPCC, so that there is really cross-pollination between climate change and biodiversity, which is very much needed in the way we envisage the future, particularly regarding climate change mitigation techniques and plans. So we cannot do that alone, so it's a call to all of you here. We have a little tool which we call TRACK. It's basically a website. The address is here. And if you are aware of a particular impact, a particular use of one of our reports, the idea would be that you go to that website and that you tell us, and that way we will be able to keep track and inform everyone about how their work in the IBES report is being used. I come to my second part, which is a focus on a particular regional assessment. In March 2018, a couple of months ago, the plenary of IBES approved the summary for policymakers of four regional assessments, which you see here for Africa, Europe and Central Asia, the Americas and Asia and the Pacific, together covering all of the terrestrial ecosystems as well as all of the coastal zones. And there was also a report on land degradation and restoration, which was approved at the same time. So these regional assessments, when taken together, involved quite a large group of people. This is not all of them, of course,
about 450 of them. They were selected out of thousands of nominations. Together, they analyzed about 15,000 publications. And over the course of the production of these reports, a significant number of comments, about 20,000 total, were submitted. They will soon be posted online. We are committed to being open and transparent so that everyone can find their individual comment and the response that was given to that comment, which is also what IPCC is doing, and it's quite a task. So these are some views here of the plenary of IBES in Colombia in March. This approval of summary for policymakers are really quite almost a dramatic task with this really significant dialogue between the scientists who produced the report and the representatives of governments. IBES has 130 governments, and in addition, there are also some observer governments and many representatives of civil society. SCB, for example, is always there. And for each one of these reports, it took about between 25 and 30 hours of this dialogue for then leading to governments being able to approve the report. And as you see here, everyone at the end had a sense of felt a sense of achievement, and it has now, thanks to this process, become a set of reports that are co-owned by the scientific community and by governments, as well as by others. So those reports collectively, those four regional reports, addressed the questions that you see here. They embrace our conceptual framework, if you are familiar with the conceptual framework of IBES. And I would like to note that this Friday here at ECCB at 11, there will be an IBES symposium, which in the presence of the experts who have done the work and who are going to then make more specific presentations on the highlights that I'm giving here today. So this is the first question: how do biodiversity and ecosystem services contribute to the economy, livelihood, food security, well-being, and good quality of life? What are the status trends and potential future dynamics? What are the pressures driving changes? What are actual and potential impacts of various policies and interventions? And the last one about addressing flagging gaps in order to be able to address them later. What's important to be aware of is the use of confidence language in all of our assessments, in every statement that is made in the summary for policymakers. Every statement is accompanied by a confidence term. There are four, and it's a mix of the level of evidence we have together with the level of agreement within the scientific community. So when we say that something is well established, it means that there was enough evidence and high agreement among experts. So coming now to our region here, Europe and Central Asia, this is here the entire region that was assessed as part of that report. And there are four subregions: Western Europe, Central Europe, Central Asia, Eastern Europe. The little two-letter acronyms here are what are going to what's going to be used in my next series of slides when I'm going to show a few slides that are a bit complex that really give some snapshots of the region, a narrative for that region. So the report looked at what IBES calls the contributions of nature to people, 18 categories, which are in three different categories here, 18 contributions in three categories, regulating contributions, material contributions, non-material contributions, and it then looked at the impact of on the quality of life, going from instrumental types of values such as food and energy to more of relational values such as environmental justice and equity, for example. So those are. This is the first highlight on how the region is doing. This first slide is on non-material contributions to people, and it says that the majority of regulating and of non-material contributions have declined since 1960 in Europe and Central Asia. Again, this is based on the analysis of hundreds of publications, and this here in the columns is for the four subregions, and here is a summary for the region itself, and you have the regulating contributions, the material contributions, and the non-material, where when it's good, when there is an increase, it's in green, and when there was a decrease, it is in red. And this lowering of these contributions was at the expense of the increase in material contribution, which you see here, was at the expense of these other services or contributions. And this is what the report says. So Europe and Central Asia use more renewable natural resources than it produces. This is here shown by a deficit between ecological footprint and biocapacity. Note here diversity within the region and Finland in particular. I don't have time to go in detail. Sianne told me I only have 5 minutes left, so I will breeze through here. This is the biodiversity of Europe and Central Asia, which is in continuous strong decline. Again, the same past and present here, with, as you see, everything being orange or red between moderate, meaning moderate or strong decline for terrestrial, inland, and marine systems. The report showed, gave a lot of new numbers substantiating these same facts, which I will not read here. This is a snapshot of the direct driver, the land use, climate change, invasive species, pollution, extraction, for all of the units of analysis. And the conclusion here is that land use change is the major direct drivers of change, but that the impact of climate change is increasing rapidly for that region. This is a very unfriendly graphic here, but it's a very important one. We will zoom in for just a second. It really is a table of all of the policy options and opportunity for what we call mainstreaming biodiversity, meaning to consider biodiversity not only within its box, which is typically ministries of the environment, but in all of the other places that use biodiversity and that are part and should be more part of the solution, being agriculture, forestry, fisheries, extractive industries, and so on. And so in green, you have instruments of policies where this has been effectively implemented in the region, and in purple here, where it's under development, and in red, when it has not yet been initiated. So quite a bit of work that has gone into this graphic here. And we zoom in just to see a bit better. This is for agriculture, again, for the subregions. And it shows here, for example, that when it comes to economic and financial instruments, these two regions here have started to phase out harmful subsidy, whereas in those two regions here, Eastern Europe and Central Asia, this has not yet been initiated. So a basis to think about policy options for each sub-region in Europe and Central Asia. So what is next? So when this report came out, there really was a huge interest, and I would say even larger interest than what we would have expected. We often think when we go to our meetings that everyone has heard it all before, but in fact there were many newspapers, local newspapers, specialized journals that told us that they were not aware of this issue and of the importance and the emergency of the issue. And so it really shows the power of knowledge and the power of the community getting together and getting the message out. So this is some of the impact in the traditional media, in the social media. And what we're doing now is like here today, we are really working at different levels. We, of course, continue our in-depth work with the conventions, so Convention on Biological Diversity, also UN conventions to combat desertification for the land degradation and restoration assessment. We work with governments at the national level. For example, Finland recently had its own presentation of the assessment, but there have been some in South Africa. Last week, I was in Bern in Switzerland, where the government was also welcoming the report in the presence of ministers of the various sectors that we just spoke about. And we are also engaging and continuing to work with our base, you guys, the scientific community, of course. And so, and this is my last slide here. Where we go next now is that we focus our attention to the global assessment of biodiversity and ecosystem services. It's the first time that the environment at large is reviewed since the release of the Millennium Assessment in 2005. So it's really an important product for all of us. Right now, there is an opportunity to peer review the chapters and the summary for policymakers. So I would really like to invite all of you to go to the IBES website to register and to offer comments so that we improve the quality of our reports. And to conclude, what I would really like to say fundamentally is to thank you for all of your good works, for all of the support that you've been providing to IBES. When I go every year to the plenary, to government, I have now started to quantify in dollars the time that you collectively contribute to IBES, and for 2017 alone, that came to something between $5 and $10 million, which is very significant. It's the same amount that governments contribute in cash to IBES, and that corresponds to your free time, depending on whether you count 10% or 20% of your time. Some of your colleagues involved in IBES will tell you that they've contributed more than that, and so it would be even more than 10 million. So that's really significant. It's also really, I think, a beautiful effort, just like IPCC, and it really shows the commitment of scientists. So thank you, and continue to be involved. And with that, I would like to wish everyone a good meeting and to thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.
Don't go anywhere, because I believe we have some time for questions. Yes. If there's a question. Yes. Okay, we have a question over here. And when you are asking, please use the microphone.
Thank you, and very, very nice summary and overview of the Pollinator and Europe and Central Asia report. I'm Dmitry Shigil from GBIF. My question is, about the balance between B, which is biodiversity, and ES, which is ecosystem services, in the work of IBES. From my first IBES meeting in Bonn 2015 and then the conference in Montpellier, I noticed the increasing shift towards ES. And I worry that the B as such, the fundamental biodiversity assessments, lose the strength in the IBES work. What is your vision to protect the fundamental biodiversity assessment and to balance the currently anthropocentric, very anthropocentric focus of IBES?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to comfort you and to really reassure you, rather, and to say that it really is not the vision that IBES is promoting. If you look at the conceptual framework, if you look at the work that is done on values, for example, you will see that IBES has been promoting all along multiple values of biodiversity, so that biodiversity, its intrinsic values, the relational values, and not only the utilitarian values and the services are at the heart of the project. So that is very much a part of the project, and I would not think that there is a digression from that original vision. And if you actually look at the reports, I believe that you will see that you have these multiple views.
Yeah. Okay, thank you once more, Anne. And we are moving forward. Next, we will have Dr. Christiana Paschke-Palmer. Christiana is the Executive Secretary of the Convention on Biological Diversity. She assumed office just over a year ago. And prior to her appointment as the Executive Secretary, Christiana has served as the Romania's Minister for Environment, Waters, and Forests. Christiana's training is in systems ecology and management of natural capital, as well as in public administration. She has a PhD on international relations with a focus on business management and environmental sustainability. Today, Christiana is first going to provide us an overview of experiences gained in the CBD during the last 25 years regarding to conserving biodiversity. Then she will discuss the global biodiversity framework beyond 2020. And she will end by making a few observations on how scientists, that is all of us, can contribute to the work of CBD. Please welcome Christiana Paschke-Palmer.
Good morning. I was going to start my my speech because I don't have a PowerPoint. I'm just going to make a few remarks by asking all of you to raise your hands. Who does know what CBD stands for? Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. That's probably the highest response I usually get when I'm asking that question. And oftentimes in with my colleagues in the United Nations, when that question is being asked, they're like, biodiversity, CBD, what is that, really? Anyway, dear rector of the university, dear Professor Jan, dear Anne, distinguished members of the European Society for Conservation Biology, thank you very much for inviting me to be here with you today. I'm really pleased and honored to be able to share a few thoughts with you, but also to learn a lot from your knowledge. As Professor Jan was saying, I started as a scientist, but meanwhile I diverted through various, I guess, other lenses to look at biodiversity agenda, including from a government and practitioner experience. And I have to say that all of it, it's very, very important and being able to understand the challenges we are dealing with and what could be maybe some of the solutions. So I would like to thank the European Society for Conservation Biology for organizing the event, and particularly for the theme of planetary well-being, which is a concept that captures the well-being of people as well as the integrity and sustainability of Earth's ecosystems, maybe not so much focusing on the anthropocentric angle, which I fully agree with the person who was asking the question earlier. And I believe this Congress perhaps could be also considered as an important contribution to the 25th anniversary of our convention. The UN Biodiversity Convention this year celebrates 25 years since its entry into force, and we are quite proud of what we managed to achieve, I think, as a global community during this time. In my remarks, I would like to address three main points. First, where we are with respect to in-situ conservation and the experiences gained in the CBD during the last 25 years. Secondly, the global biodiversity framework beyond 2020. It's something that starts to preoccupy a lot of colleagues in our community. And the need for larger transformational change at the systems level. And finally, indeed, how can you, all of you, and the community of scientists contribute to these processes, but also bringing at the forefront the knowledge that we all need to put up good plans of action. So let me start with the first point, where we are with respect to in-situ conservation. And I don't need to tell you, you are experts in this field, and after Anne's presentation, I think a lot of the data is there, but everywhere, from high mountains to the high seas, and from the Arctic to the tropical forests, and in our own backyards, the signs of declining biodiversity and the potential collapse of life-sustaining systems are becoming too dire to ignore. Despite knowing how to conserve and sustainably manage Earth's lifeline, that is, the biological diversity, we are not doing enough of what we ought to do. The great conservation lesson of the 19th century was the need to preserve the habitats. The advent of industrialization ravaged once pristine and largely unfragmented landscapes at a speed virtually unthinkable to our ancestors living in the 18th century. By the end of the 19th century, a conservation movement focusing on the preservation of habitats was born. And it was timely and adequate response then, and it made a difference. Nowadays, however, we have over 45 million square kilometers of the Earth's surface declared and managed in various categories of protected areas. And I think, indeed, this is a significant achievement. But the news is not all that good, because the planet's biodiversity is increasingly imperiled, not just the iconic and high-profile vertebrate species, but also, most ominously, even the humble organisms that are an essential part of the web of life are in trouble. And the pollinators, you know, are just one example. In this context, the adoption of the Strategic Plan for Biodiversity Conservation 2011 to 2020 and the 20 Global Biodiversity Targets, or BHE targets in the jargon, was a historic achievement, providing an ambitious benchmark for the future and clearly articulating the essential role of biodiversity in achieving sustainable development. Since their adoption, the IHE targets have had a clear impact around the world, catalyzing political attention and action on the ground, as well as inspiring and informing other global processes, including the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. And you know very well, and Anne also presented in her remarks, the two dedicated sustainable development goals for biodiversity, SDG 14 on oceans and life in waters, and SDG 15 on life on land. So we have 195 parties to the convention, that is almost universal membership, with the exception of the United States and the Holy See, the Vatican. Pretty much all the other countries around the world are part of our convention. Over 150 of them have developed national biodiversity strategies and action plans, or NBSAPs. that translate the global ambition embraced in the vision, mission, and targets of the strategic plan at the national level. Because indeed, it is at the national level that priorities are being set and commitments and national contribution made. The progress we see globally is a result of the collective effort of the parties, including local governments, businesses, indigenous people and local communities, NGOs, conservation practitioners and scientists, as well as individual citizens. But, dear colleagues, next year, in 2019, the CBD Secretariat will produce the Global Biodiversity Outlook, which is based on the reports that each country, which is a member of the convention, provides us. And this would be a year before the end date of the strategic plan. However, I think we have all the indications that, unfortunately, the targets will not be met by and large, perhaps with the exception of Target 11 on protected areas, where we are seeing very good progress and some improvements in the other targets. We cannot say that in this decade period we were able to achieve all these high ambitious commitments that were put out there, or maybe some don't even consider them very ambitious. So this is worrying and a cause of reflection, particularly as we engage in the design and the conceptualization of the post-2020 framework. There are many reasons. We will analyze them, one of which is that we hear the countries needed time to distill and translate these global targets to the national action and develop a national context and national level targets. That takes time. The revision of the national biodiversity strategies and action plan takes time. So almost half of the time of this decade was dedicated to revising these strategies. And in that, implementation itself and having and seeing a difference on the ground has suffered some. On the positive side, though, I think we can also note some important progress for in-situ conservation. For example, global coverage of terrestrial protected areas reached 14.8%, approaching the 17% minimum called by in Target 11. The number of CBD parties with at least 17% coverage now stands at 91, so almost half of them. Marine protected area coverage, on the other hand, reached over 7% for the global ocean, representing an almost threefold increase since 2020 when the strategic plan was adopted. 34 maritime CBD parties now have at least 10% coverage of their coastal and marine areas under designated marine protected areas. Regarding ecological representation, 361 terrestrial ecoregions have now at least 17% protected area cover. 94 marine ecoregions and 4 pelagic provinces have at least 10% marine protected areas. About half of these areas, recognized as harboring the most critical and diverse habitats and species, are protected. And these areas are recognized as key biodiversity areas, KBAs. Ensuring that the remaining portion of the KBAs is well managed is of utmost importance, and it is very urgent. So, ladies and gentlemen, despite these positive developments, progress is not sufficient for many of the qualifying elements of Target 11, including connectivity, effective and equitable management, amongst others. Quantitative expansion of the global protected area estate, while very desirable, will not be sufficient to halt global biodiversity losses if it is not managed effectively and if it does not have appropriate governance and equity measures in place. And you may all be familiar with the recent study published in Science by Professor Watson criticizing precisely this, the effectiveness of the management of protected areas. So in post-2020, we absolutely need to do better on that aspect. Currently, the global protected area system is dominated by state-managed protected areas. And in the UN Convention on Biodiversity, we have invited parties to diversify and strengthen protected area governance types and to recognize the importance contribution of co-managed protected areas, private protected areas and territories, and areas conserved by indigenous people and local communities. Equally important, I believe, that areas conserved for cultural and spiritual values with governance and management that respect and are informed by those values often result in positive biodiversity outcomes. And perhaps it is high time to fully consider the linkages between biological and cultural diversity and heritage, nature and culture, if we are to achieve coherence and success in the coming decades. Other effective area-based conservation measures, or OECMs as they are known, offer an important tool to do this. The national commitments communicated by parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity on Target 11, if implemented as proposed, will allow to reach the minimum coverage targets for the terrestrial realm by 2020 and even bypass this target. But, and I think it's possible to do that, we have still two more years to go before 2020, and I believe that, like, you know, when you run a marathon, I'm not a marathon runner, but, you know, I observe people giving it the last bit of energy for the last 100 miles, or the last 100 meters, not miles. it's really important to give this last push, the last level of ambition and action to achieve more on the targets and commitments that we have, because we are already switching our mindset towards reflecting what should post-2020 be about, and I encourage governments and all stakeholders to not forget about the current plan. So let me move now to the second point. From today's landscape to the post-2020 global biodiversity framework and the need for larger systemic transformational change. The fate of this will be, of course, designed and adopted and decided by our parties. But for now, I prefer to call it a framework and not a strategy, simply because I feel that we have so many strategies and so many plans, and sometimes the energy gets absorbed in defining or refining strategies instead of, you know, going for the action. And as I mentioned in the beginning of my address, the destruction of biodiversity and ecosystem compounds and accelerates other global challenges, such as climate change, water security, food security, and public health, to name just a few. Equally interesting, in the World Economic Forum's Global Risk Report that they put out every year, this year in January in Davos, they listed for the first time biodiversity as one of the top 10 global risks. And this is unprecedented. It's unprecedented because it's drawing the attention of a community that is not normally part of our circles. It's the community of businesses, of the politicians that are now more and more starting to pay attention. And evidently, as Anne was illustrating, the IPBES reports already called a lot of attention on this subject. Policy ambitions agreed upon so far, as well as concrete commitments and actions, while important, have proven not to be enough. Ecological resilience research demonstrates that there is a risk of ecological boundaries being crossed, and you're best to tell us if that's true or not. This could potentially result in tipping points in climate and ecosystems that might lead to an acceleration of environmental disruptions, cascading effects, and possibly irreversible damage. These pressures are stemming from many causes, but one of which, I think, is our classical economic development models, which do not account for the value of natural capital. They are also embedded in societal structures and preferences, notably unsustainable consumption and production patterns, as well as socioeconomic and cultural dynamics. So if we are to be more successful in our efforts as a global community to avoid catastrophic collapse of the planetary systems, it is imperative to address the root causes of the biodiversity loss and perhaps to move away from considering this only a problem for biologists and conservationists and acknowledge that this rich capital constitutes the essential foundation that supports life on Earth, all forms of life on Earth, including it's very important for human development and planetary well-being. So this would require a paradigm shift post-2020 and bringing biodiversity at the center of the economic, social, and political decision-making. And I have to tell you, also having had the opportunity to serve as a minister in a government, that that's not going to be an easy transition. And it will require an effort from all of us and a very consistent effort and loud voice to make that point across. Our efforts, therefore, cannot merely seek to remediate and soften the negative impacts of unsustainability. We need to address the root causes that have led to these symptoms of unsustainability. Shifting to new ways of eco-friendly production and consumption, reorienting economic development pathways towards an economy within the ecological boundaries, while creating opportunities for societal well-being in the long term, are just some of the pillars that will have to support the post-2020 biodiversity framework. And I think to do that, we need to engage on a transformative path rooted in systems approach and in systems science and in systems transition that would enable not only a whole-of-government approach to biodiversity, but also the engagement of all societal stakeholders in the implementation of the biodiversity objectives at global but also national and local levels. Innovative approaches to conservation, creating new incentive models, including financial and engaging relevant actors through public-private partnerships at scale, are just few examples of actions that could help redirect behavior change and political priorities in order to mitigate biodiversity losses and generate greater value attached to protection of our natural systems. So with this in mind, I would like to offer just few reflections on elements to be taken into consideration for the design of the post-2020 global biodiversity framework. And let me start by recalling that the Aichi targets were not intended to be an end in and in itself by 2020, but rather a stepping stone towards more ambitious targets on the road to realizing the 2050 vision of the Convention, which is living in harmony with nature. This vision is embedded in the current strategic plan, and it states that, and I quote, by 2050, biodiversity is valued, conserved, restored, and wisely used, maintaining ecosystem services, sustaining a healthy planet, and delivering benefits essential for all people. This vision remains valid as an ultimate goalpost, but we will need to consider scaled-up, integrated, and very tangible actions and timelines to really deliver it. I don't think we can afford to go ahead into an exercise of another decade establishing new targets and, you know, maybe coming out of it in 2030, drawing the line and making an assessment and realizing there is too little progress. So we have to be a lot more ambitious than that in our implementation efforts. Credible data and science to assess the implications of various policy options post-2020 and up to 2050 will be absolutely essential. And this is where IPBES reports and all of your work, it's critical for our work. Moreover, transition research perspectives could help guide actions to address the drivers of biodiversity loss and to buttress processes that could better integrate biodiversity sustainability pathways into economic sectors and economic development. So building on the positive results of the Aichi targets, learning from the success but also failures of their implementation, and using Aichi as the framework that links biodiversity to the 2030 Sustainable Development Agenda, we will need to also reflect on overarching global ambition targets by 2050, which will integrate the conservation needs with restoration and sustainable use of terrestrial and marine systems. So in line with the three objectives of the Convention, which, since you know well the Convention, you also know the objectives, conservation, sustainable use, and equitable sharing of benefits. We could ambitiously aim to achieve an effective and sustainably managed whole Earth by 2050. I think this should be the level of ambition. We want a whole Earth, the whole planet, sustainably managed. Much of this has to do with enhancing the mainstreaming of biodiversity considerations into various sectors of the economy. And this is now made possible also by the decisions taken by the governments in the CBD at our last COP in 2016 in Mexico, when the mainstreaming of biodiversity was taken to be considered into agriculture, fisheries, forestry, and tourist sectors. And if you think about it, these are major economic sectors for many countries around the world. And at our upcoming COP, which will be in November this year in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, parties will again decide on mainstreaming biodiversity in other sectors of the economy, such as infrastructure, energy, mining, oil and gas, health, and manufacturing. So if you think about it, between these last two COPs and these mainstreaming decisions, we have opened the door and the space to discuss biodiversity in essentially all key sectors of the economy. What we need post-2020 is to see how this becomes really mainstream. How do we have a transformative economic business model, societal models, where we don't talk about biodiversity just in isolation somewhere, you know, in the Ministry of Environment, but it's becoming a topic for the forefront conversations. An essential element also of the post-2020 framework should reflect the need for enhanced mechanisms to review and report progress on implementation under the convention. Indicators and use of, you know, the technologies, data, big data, satellites, it's offering us the opportunity to do a lot better in assessing the progress. But that has to be embedded in whatever will become the post-2020 framework. Equally important, the setting of overarching global targets should be rooted in the best scientific evidence available, both from natural sciences, but also social and behavioral sciences. And I'm saying that because, you know, you all know CBD, most likely you all know Aichi targets, but once we go outside this room, how many people have heard or known what Aichi stands for? And if we look at what our colleagues in the Climate Change Convention have done in the Paris Agreement, a lot of action that was mobilized and led to the success of Paris was the fact that they had one global target that was easy to communicate and easy to understand, 2 degrees. And we are often asked, what is the equivalent of 2 degrees for biodiversity? Because when we start speaking the language of Aichi, people get lost. So, you know, another lesson for post-2020 is perhaps how do we come up with 1 or 2 aspiring, mobilizing global targets that touch the hearts and minds of people. Furthermore, the road to 2050 and a world in which we live in harmony with nature needs to account for other global dynamics and forces that have an impact on biodiversity. The fourth industrial revolution and all the technology developments associated with it is just one example. Decade-by-decade action plans to 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050, with concrete objectives and a toolbox for actions are essential to guide our progress. Another critical element is the engagement of all societal levels, from decision makers to business and citizens and scientists, in a common narrative that emphasizes that safeguarding biodiversity is about safeguarding human and planetary well-being. And also that investing in biodiversity is a good investment. It's an investment that provides multiple solutions and benefits to many global challenges, including security, migration, peace, and development. So all of these ideas will require detailed discussions in the coming 2 years, leading to COP15 in 2020, which will be hosted by China in Beijing. So finally, let me come to my third point. What is your role as conservation scientists and practitioners to provide knowledge and contribute to the design of the post-2020 global biodiversity architecture? And from the onset, I want to say you have a critical role to play because you provide us the knowledge which should inform all the decisions. We need your help to provide better science-based evidence and help make the targets smart. We also need your help to communicate the science in ways that is understood by our fellow citizens who may be more concerned about daily challenges related to employment, livelihoods, health, and many other aspects. We need a compelling story to explain that nature provides a multitude of assets and services to the society, effective solutions to global problems, and thus it is not only a threat, but also an opportunity. And I want to pause just for a minute here again to, I cannot emphasize more the role that you have in also communicating the science in a way that it's easily understood. Because you may be surprised, but there is a big disconnect between what you do, your work in your own communities, and the politicians and some of the policymakers out there. And again, I can speak because I was wearing both hats. And oftentimes, despite the best science available, decisions, when it's coming to political decisions, are being made based on complete different considerations. Maybe political gains, maybe, you know, the next immediate prime time on TV. And science sometimes falls behind. And it's important that your voice is being heard loud and clear. So secondly, you need to help your own governments to be accountable. When your country provides official reports to CBD on achievements around nature conservation and the sustainable management of natural resources, be part of the solution and contribute with questions, information, and actions. And thirdly, offer your ideas for content and priorities for the post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework. Be part of the open process that is about to formally begin in Egypt when the parties adopt the process that we designed for the consultations for post-2020, I would like to hear your voice there. Because often I ask, what is the science? What is the science telling us about these targets? The 10% and the 17% were the result of negotiations, but what is the science telling us? How much space do we need to put aside for nature? How do we need to sustainably use? And it seems that you actually have the answers. We just need to get all the answers on our table. So I have 1 minute, I think, and I'm coming to the concluding remarks. In the 25 years of the Convention on Biological Diversity, we celebrated significant progress made by parties together with many of our partners. I started in this field in 1991, just as Romania was emerging out of communism, and I can tell a huge difference between, you know, when I told my parents I'm going to be an ecologist, they froze. They said, what is that? And so we are in a very different era, and we've come a long way. But as I mentioned on and on during this talk, it's not enough. We have seen enormous improvements in protected area governance models and new sustainable use approaches to managing key natural resources. The value of biodiversity for society, from addressing our social and economic needs to supporting our health and well-being, is getting greater recognition. Furthermore, biodiversity lies at the heart of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, and that's not a small achievement. But there is still much more to be done. In science, the best available data coupled with indigenous and local traditional knowledge could provide a strong basis for conservation policy. At the same time, we need to be strategic in our choices to ensure that policies that are proposed can be translated effectively into action and implemented on the ground. I cannot stress enough the importance of implementation. So effective conservation in the 21st century is going to require a new and different approach, maybe not so new, we've been talking about it, but I think it's time to implement it. And I think indeed we need a new deal for nature, a deal that calls on all of us to design and implement a transformative approach in the way we engage and connect with biodiversity, with the planet, and ultimately with ourselves. So let us all bring the collective knowledge together and recognize the sense of urgency to act boldly and decisively to safeguard planetary health and well-being for all. Thank you for your attention and good luck in the coming days.
Thank you, Christiana. And now, if there is a question to the Executive Secretary, we can have one. Okay, here we have a question in the center.
Hello, my name is Maëlys de Rousseau, and I wanted to ask you if you believe that the Global Pact for the Environment that is currently being discussed will help achieving this new deal for nature that you mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very good question. I wonder that myself. And I'm actually going to Paris tomorrow morning to meet with people in the French government, but also with those who are proponents of the Global Pact for Nature. Honestly, I think any effort that would bring nature, environment more to the forefront of the conversation and the decision making, it's very, very important. So I don't know yet, and it's probably early days to tell what form and shape the Global Pact will take. But if that's meant to reaffirm the need to really very seriously consider environment, and by that I mean all aspects of the environment, including biodiversity, I think that's a very good thing. And obviously, France is very proud of the achievement of the Paris Accord. It was a huge diplomatic success, but not only diplomatic success. So it's natural that it's also from France the leadership and the inspiration came to have this more ambitious view on nature. So I hope, you know, it can't harm, at least the way it's looking right now. Thank you.
I think I saw another question right here. In the
and front. There is another one there.
Thanks. Hey, Nicola from the University of Melbourne. Thank you for that great overview. I was just wondering that at the same time when we're taking this progress or these next steps on the international policy level, at the national level, there seems to be a bit of opposite trend. We see this kind of bit of a push of deregulizing development and maybe pushing the environmental protection into the margins. And I'm just kind of curious to hear your views of on this issue. Like, do you see it as a threat? And also, how can we reconcile these kind of two opposing trends? Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I think the picture is mixed because you have to take it country by country, and there are countries where we see some step backwards, and that's not encouraging. But I think that again is just reinforcing the need for those of us who have the knowledge and the understanding to step out, perhaps sometimes out of our comfort zone, and make the case and put pressure on the government or. Rally with other stakeholders in coalitions of actions to ensure that there is no, going backwards. But on the other hand, it's true. You open the news every day, and we live in a very complex world, rapidly changing. The reason I mentioned the Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's also because when I attended Davos in January, it was a big eye-opener for me, both in terms of the opportunities that this might have for our agenda, because there are many opportunities in it, but also some of the risks that I think we need to be aware of, and we need to have a space to discuss and make decisions to ensure that, whatever trends and patterns are occurring, they are not harming furthermore the ocean. I mean, the planet. There is one element that I discussed with Anne and other colleagues as well. Sometimes I'm quite worried to see some of the solutions proposed as mitigating the climate impact could be very detrimental for biodiversity. And, I think the science communities need to talk a lot more together to make sure that, I mean, you know, you all know we operate in a system, so we can't try to fix one component of the system at the expense of destroying other components. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Christiana. I think we go forward. Thank you. And then what we have next is some housekeeping issues, and Mikko is going to come and give them.
Hello, it's me again. Before the coffee break, there are some important messages and news for you and notes about the program and in general about the activities during the conference. First of all, the program, we have been making some last-minute changes to the program. So please follow the online program version that you have available via online. And that's where the latest, you can find the latest changes to the program. We already somehow reorganized the symposia and sessions only last week based on the requests from you. So please recheck if you did check your talk when it's going to be, please recheck that it's still there that you think it is. And then one important thing is that we have exactly 15-minute time slots for each of the talks in sessions and symposia. So it's 15-minute sharp. And that 15-minute includes 1 minute time for people to, because we have 10 parallel sessions in this conference. So there's 1 minute time devoted to those who want to change from session to another. And during that 1 minute time, you can't talk because there's going to be music played during that 1 minute time. So you have only 14 minutes to give your talk and answer to the questions that the audience addresses. Then next mornings, on Wednesday morning, Tuesday morning, and Friday morning, the plenaries start 8:30 sharp. And the housekeeping notes are going to be after the plenary talks. So be here in time. We are very punctual. We start at 8:30. So if you want to attend the plenaries right from the start, be here. Then those of you who have been reading our web pages, you have probably seen that we have a carbon offsetting program. We have been calculating or estimating how much carbon dioxide is emitted to the atmosphere because of us, because of you traveling to Jyväskylä. And I can tell you that's not very little. It's quite an amount of carbon that is there in the atmosphere, additional carbon that is there in the atmosphere because of this conference. And therefore, we have a carbon offsetting program. We have already restored a boreal peatland here in central Finland. And we are monitoring and estimating how much time it takes from that particular peatland to sequester the carbon that we have been emitting. That was the good news. The bad news is that there was this voluntary carbon offsetting fee, and only 39% of the delegates have paid it. But luckily, there is an opportunity to still participate in carbon offsetting program. So if you still want to make, if you have not paid the carbon offsetting fee, please go to the registration desk, do it, pay your share of the restoration program. Or if you have already done it, you can do it twice. You can pay some extra. And then on Friday, the Congress banquet will be associated with a festival close by. It's called Sataman Yö, Harbor Nights. It's going to be a true festival where we will have a VIP area reserved for just of the delegates of the conference. And we have high-profile performance in the festival. And also dinner will be served there. And tickets for the banquet and the festival are still available. So if you don't have a ticket and you would like to participate, please go to the registration desk and ask for banquet tickets. It's 30 euros. And that includes the dinner and the program. Not very much. We have a special equity, inclusion, and diversity theme that is going through this Congress. Our diversity officer, Jenna Purhonen, is organizing a lunchtime discussion for those who are interested in issues of equity, inclusion, and diversity. But before lunchtime, Thursday lunchtime discussion, which will be held in this large hall, A1 hall downstairs. Before that, you can post your post-it notes on the equity, inclusion, and diversity wall, which is beside the info desk downstairs. So if you have any suggestions, ideas, what are the issues to discuss during this lunchtime discussion on Thursday, please go there and put your post-it note on the wall. Then one final thing. I have been requested to advertise a talk which will be on Wednesday at 3:30 by Zach Bainham Hurd. And Jack is doing his PhD thesis on conservation conflict management. And he's carrying out an online survey to identify a priority rank of conservation management approaches. And he asks you, all the delegates during this conference, to complete this questionnaire or this survey. It only takes 5 to 10 minutes, and you can do it online. You can complete it on a phone, tablet, or laptop. And so if you are interested in that, please go to listen to Zach's talk on Wednesday afternoon, and you will hear more instructions about that. So these were the housekeeping notes, but before the coffee break, I still would like to thank the local organizing committee. As a chair of the organizing committee, it would have been possible to have this conference without so marvelous local organizing committee. So Emilia Lampi, first of all, thank you for being such an excellent secretary for the local organizing committee. And then I would like to mention Jenna Purhonen. Jenna is our diversity officer. If Jenna is here. And then Atte Komonen and Panu Halve, very active, irreplaceable guys in the local organizing committee, for example, responsible for field excursions and also other things. Thanks, Atte and Panu. And my colleague, Janne Kotiaho, he's been very active, and on top of co-chairing the scientific committee, he's been very active organizing this Congress. Thanks, Janne. And then Maiju Peura, Maria Trivinio, and Eini Nieminen have been very active members of the local organizing committee. For example, they have been responsible for organizing the pre-Congress courses for you. Thanks for being in the local organizing committee. Mm. And then we have had Linda Mustajärvi, and Linda is our carbon offsetting officer, and she's going to give her talk on the estimates of the carbon emissions that we have caused and also our ability to compensate for that. Thanks, Linda, for being part of the local organizing committee. And then I would like to thank Tarumaya Heilala-Rasimov and Elina Leskinen, who are our support members from the University of Jyväskylä. Without the help of Tarumaya and Elina, this Congress would not have been possible. Thanks, Elina and Tarumaya. And my final thanks goes to Janne Seppänen. He is an irreplaceable member of the local organizing committee. On top of providing us with the computer code, he's also good source of Finnish humor. So thanks, Janne, for being part of the team. And now it's time for the first coffee break, and the coffee will be served in this C1 hall where the posters are. Thanks.